It's been good to meet with you this morning, to worship together, to study the scriptures in community. And so I too want to greet you in Jesus' name this morning. A question that I often get asked is, so why did you become a teacher? And maybe it's because I was a lousy farmer. I'm not sure. I wonder sometimes if I didn't cost my dad more than I made for him, between the cows that the cows that I shouldn't have milked into the tank or the equipment that I busted. You know, one of the things they did trust me, my dad and my brothers trusted me with, was disking. You can't do a whole lot of damage disking. And yet, even there, it was more than once that I'd be... See, I like disking because that's where you could think, and you could plan, you could envision projects, and so I like disking. But on more than one occasion, I'd be going down through the field, and this was back in the CB era. The CB would come to life, and it would be one of my brothers, and they'd say something like this: Stephen, you may want to put the disc down. Maybe I became a teacher because of Mrs. McGill. She was my second grade teacher. Our family moved from Virginia, where I was in a sheltered Mennonite community at a small Mennonite school, to South Carolina, where I was placed into a public school. And in this school, I was a minority. And the people talked funny. I could not understand them. And in addition to that, in my classroom, there was this loudspeaker on the wall, right behind the teacher up there on the wall. And during the day, that thing would come to life and sounds would come out of it. And apparently they were important sounds, because after they quit, people would do things in response to what they heard. And I couldn't understand it. And so I started crying. And I cried all that day, and I went home and was fine. And then the next day I came back, and when I got back into this chaos, I cried again, and I cried the third day and the fourth day and the fifth day. How long do you want this service to go? I cried the sixth day. I cried, and I kind of remember it as maybe a week or so. But when I was talking to my family about it a couple years back, they said, oh no, it was at least a month. Mrs. McGill was my teacher, and just a lovely, godly black lady. She knew how to love her students well. I remember her inviting me to come and stand by her during recess. I didn't want to play because I was so scared of everyone, and so I would stand by her chair and she would ask me questions. One day Mrs. McGill came to class, and I think this was still in my crying period, but she came to class. She said, students, it's exciting. The principal has announced there's a contest, and I need a volunteer from this class. Someone to make a poster, because every class in the school, there was about 600 students in the school, every class in the school is supposed to turn in a poster on recycling. And while she's announcing this poster contest, she's just looking at me. She's not looking at anyone else. She's just focusing in on me. And she says, is there anyone here in this whole class that would volunteer to do this poster? And so I just kind of eased my hand up. And as soon as she saw my hand, she stopped. She says, class, do y'all see that? Do you see his hand? She said, you know, that's what I love about Stephen. He is so quick to volunteer to do things. Now, I don't know why she thought that, because I hadn't been quick to volunteer to do anything except cry up to that point. Mrs. McGill loved me well. Maybe that's why I went into teaching. We've been considering together six words that describe an Anabaptist worldview, its distinctive beliefs and values. Last evening, I offered a model of first and second things, a model that came really as I was studying Matthew 6, 33, and trying to understand the tension in that passage and how to properly relate the two things there. And then I find that it relates to so many other things in life. And the word, the emphasis that I want to think about this morning, this model is going to help us think about this one as well. I would also say the language for that model came from Lewis, who somewhere in his writing says that put first things first and you get second things thrown in. Put second things first and you lose them both. We've talked last evening about brotherhood and about submission. And we're ready for a third word. And this is going to be another S word. And that word is salmon. No, I'm just kidding. But in order to talk about the S word, I want to talk about salmon. Why do salmon swim upstream? We know that when salmon are spawned, when they're born, they swim down freshwater streams out into the ocean in many cases, and for a couple years they're out there swimming around and so on, and then when they want to spawn, they return home, and biologists tell us that they return in almost every situation to within 5 miles of where they were spawned. It's an amazing thing. Now, there's been a lot of theories over the years as to what allows this fish that has swum thousands of miles to actually make it back home. And the current understanding is that it's because salmon smell good. Well, they have a good sense of smell. And so their home, where they respond, has an odor. And that odor, of course, is made up of all kinds of molecules that carry that odor. And those molecules spread out through the water, out into the ocean. And so when the salmon is ready to return home, they detect those odors, turn in the direction where the odors are more concentrated, and keep going that direction, where it gets more and more concentrated until they get home. It's not merely a matter of going upstream for the salmon. Their focus is not, oh, let's see, what direction is the water going? I'm going to go the opposite way. No, the salmon has a positive vision, a positive smell in this case, of where to go. And so their focus is not primarily against the stream. The focus is home. And it is that focus that gives them good reason to go against the stream. Now, I find this to be a compelling picture of the gospel for the believer. Christ is our home odor. A focus on Christ, of following Christ, is a positive vision of what we are to be and to become. Now, early Anabaptism had an expression for this. Their interest in following Jesus, they called nakfoga Christi, following Christ. That was a focus. That was the home odor that drove them. It describes the gospel in terms of following him. It reads the Bible through the lens of the teachings and life of Christ. It understands the goal of life to love Christ and to become like him. But we're looking for a word, and I said the word we're looking for begins with an S, a word to describe this emphasis. Christ-center doesn't start with an S. Nokfoga Christi doesn't start with an S. I've avoided both of those words, not because they're not good. Christ-centered is great. Nokfoga Christi, that's a great term. But I've looked for something else to describe this emphasis. Why? Well, here's why. According to one Gallup poll, 84% of Americans believe that Jesus is God. 66% of Americans claim to be Christ-centered. All Christian groups make a claim to be Christ-centered. And yet, according to Ron Sider in The Scandal of the Evangelical Conscience, evangelical Christians are as likely to embrace lifestyles every bit as hedonistic, materialistic, self-centered, and sexually immoral as the world in general. Is this what Christ-centered includes? We go on. Sider writes that divorce is more common among born-again Christians than in the general American population. He says that only 6% of evangelicals tithe. That's not that evangelicals tithe only 6%. It's that only 6% of evangelicals tithe. He says that white evangelicals are the most likely people to object to neighbors of another race. That sexual promiscuity among evangelical youth is only a little less outrageous than that of their non-evangelical peers. He says that since 1993, about 2.4 million young evangelicals have signed a pledge to wait until marriage to engage in sexual intercourse. Just 12% keep the promise. Fully 26% of traditional evangelicals do not think premarital sex is wrong. The percentage of Christian men involved in pornography is not much different than that of the unsaved. Born-again Christians spend 7 times more hours each week in front of their televisions than they spend in Bible reading, prayer, and worship. He concludes by saying that every day the church is becoming more and more like the world it allegedly seeks to change. And he wraps up his book by saying the cultural captivity of Christianity in the West is nearly complete. So is the Anabaptist emphasis on Christ, do we mean anything different here? I believe so. And that's why I'm looking for a different word. You see, what I'd suggest is that the Christian community today, that there is a significant emphasis on following Christ. And in terms of our model of last evening, that's the first thing. So we're getting that right. That is to be the focus. That is to be the concern. But if the model holds here, not only is our job to keep first things first, it is also to keep second things. And if the first thing here is following Jesus, the second thing is the understanding that following Christ will take us against the flow of the dominant culture. It will make a difference in the kinds of lives that we live, the kind of moral character that we bring to life. So I'm looking for another word. And returning here to our analogy of the salmon, see, the home odor causes the salmon to swim against the tide, the flow. It causes them to jump waterfalls, to refuse to give in to the currents that are so powerfully headed downstream. Likewise, Anabaptists, I believe, emphasize that following the home odor, Christ, will of necessity take us in an opposite direction from the prevailing culture, the spirit of the age. Following Christ will be countercultural. So there's two aspects here. Following Jesus, countercultural. First thing, second. And so for the word that captures both of these things, I'll turn to 2 Corinthians 6, verse 17. Therefore, go out from the midst and be separate from them, says the Lord, and touch no unclean thing, then I will welcome you. Anabaptists emphasize separation. And I choose this word because it includes, separation as properly understood, includes both a separation to Christ as well as a separation from evil. Christ followers will be out of sync with the dominant culture. Anabaptism emphasizes that conformity to Christ will be evidenced by a distinctiveness from those who are not following Christ. See, saying yes to Cynthia in marriage meant saying no to all other possible marriage partners. It's just like saying yes to Jesus means saying no to all other lords. It seems, as we look at the landscape of Christianity today, it seems that it's important to emphasize the first thing, but also to keep the second thing and not to divorce them. Now, living this understanding distinguished the early Anabaptists from the Protestants and Catholics. And I'd like to read an interesting passage from a writing in 1582. It's by Franz Agricola, and it was an essay entitled Against the Terrible Errors of the Anabaptists. And he said this, among the existing heretical sects, there is none which in appearance leads a more modest or pious life than the Anabaptists. As concerns their outward public life, they're irreproachable. No lying, deception, swearing, strife, harsh language, no intemperate eating and drinking, no outward personal display is found among them. But humility, patience, uprightness, neatness, honesty, temperance, straightforwardness, in such measure that one would suppose that they had the Holy Spirit of God. And then Harold Bender tells about a court case where a man was being tried for being an Anabaptist. He was accused of being an Anabaptist, but he was acquitted because he was an envious man who could not get along with others, who often started quarrels, guilty of swearing and cursing and carrying a weapon. So clearly, he couldn't be an Anabaptist. Anabaptists emphasize separation, separation to Christ, and because of that, going against the stream. Now, Anabaptism doesn't say that separation, and we need to be clear here, that separation is removing ourselves from the presence of other people. That's not what separation is. Jesus made it clear he's not calling us out of the world. But it is a separation from the direction that they're going. Jesus prays that we would be kept from the evil that is in the world. When I see this particular picture of these vehicles, I'm reminded of the story I heard of a husband who was coming home from work late, and his wife had supper ready, and she was back home anxiously waiting for her husband to get home. And as she's waiting, she's listening to the news, and on the news, she hears that they have this alert comes on and says, everybody, if you're listening to this, please be careful, because there is somebody out there on the road that is driving the opposite direction. And so she hears that, and she thinks about her husband, and so she calls her husband up on his cell phone, and she says, "Sweet," she said, "you know, honey, I'm worried about you. You need to know that there is a man out there that is going the wrong direction on the road." And her husband responded back to her and said, "Sweetheart, it's worse than you think. It's not just one person. They're all going the wrong direction." Now, you see, Anabaptists understand that. That's what it feels like sometimes. That's what following Christ can feel like. We're going a different direction. So what's a picture that would help us understand this emphasis? To understand that following Christ will make us stand out. It's an impulse that is at the heart of the Anabaptist vision. You see, there's something in our DNA that just where we expect to be different. We understand that followers of Christ are pilgrims and strangers and not the moral majority. What picture, what image captures this? I've chosen to use one of the many etchings that are found in the Martyr's Mirror. And so the picture I'm offering is the picture of a martyr. From the beginning of the Anabaptist movement, Anabaptism has understood that following Christ is so countercultural, it may even mean our death. Now, dying for Christ is the most dramatic example of swimming upstream. But the same impulse that led some of our forefathers and mothers to be martyrs is seen in other significant ways in our history. This willingness to die for Christ has also made us willing to take ethical positions that are out of sync with dominant culture, and not just dominant culture, the Christian culture as well. 500 years ago, one of those ethical positions was the insistence that the church and the state should be separated. That has now become accepted among Christian people. But 500 years ago, we were out of sync in that understanding. 150 years ago, it was the avoidance of slavery. Today, it includes an insistence on loving our enemies and not participating in war. This willingness to die for Christ has also made us willing to be out of sync not only with dominant culture, but other believers sometimes. So things like foot washing, the prayer veiling, willingness to look different, and so on. Anabaptists emphasize separation to Christ. You know, my wife and I had just a taste of, just a small little taste of this thing of going against the tide of everyone else. Recently, we were at a presentation that, for the most part, I believe was filled with Christian people. And as the presentation came to an end, they played a song that had this mixture of Christianity and Americanism and the embrace of the military and how wonderful and strong our military is, and so some kind of a mixture of all of this. And as the song started, it was almost as if we were there at an altar call. And I mean, just the whole congregation, the whole audience just rose to their feet in an embrace of this message. And it was difficult. It was difficult to stay seated. What is a practice that we're involved in that cultivates this willingness to go against the stream? To understand that following Christ calls for that. Why are Mennonites so okay in general with being different? I know there are exceptions to this, and for some of us, our oddness can be a real struggle, and I want to recognize that. But still, I'm asking, what do we do that nurtures this expectation that following Christ will put us at odds with the dominant culture? What practices cultivate this fundamental Anabaptist mindset? And I want to mention two. The first is more a set of practices that fall under the heading of faithfulness to family. And I guess I should just mention, this is my mother's family and their spouses. If any of you have read the book Vera's Journey, it's Vera is the one in the middle of this picture. But my grandmother valued family very much. But this thing of valuing family is a practice that we hold to as a people that is increasingly out of sync with the dominant values of our society. I believe it was Francis Schaeffer who said years ago, and it's even what he said is even more true now, that perhaps the most radical countercultural statement that we can make today is to commit ourselves to one person for life and to keep it. And then to have children, and together as husband and wife to invest in them, to train them, to go to church with them, to equip them for life, to nurture them toward love for God, for service, for sacrifice. This valuing of family, this practice of making family a focal point of our lives, of having regular meals together as family, increasingly sets us apart in a world that champions the non-traditional family. Some time ago, I believe it was Dunham's, one of our sons wanted to get some shoes there, and so we just said, let's just all go. And as he's looking for his shoes, and I believe his mother was helping him, the rest of us were kind of walking up and down the aisles and talking and having a good time. Nothing spectacular, just the normal kind of family interaction. And as we were doing this, some gentleman walked up to us, and he said, you know, it is such a delight to see a family enjoying each other. He said, I'm seeing it less and less all the time. A friend of mine from our church was recently visiting in China, and him and his wife, they have 5-6 children, and they were there for about 10 days. And he said that in those 10 days, they were approached over 100 times by people asking if they could take their picture with his family because of how rare that was to see. And he said invariably, if they could speak English, the man would say to my friend, you must be the happiest man in the world. Keeping faith to our spouse and our children is a practice that anchors us in separation. We're going a different direction. Now, a second practice that plants a countercultural mindset in us is the prayer veiling. Along with, this is important, along with men identifying with our women. Since few women today veil their hair, Mennonite women stick out. And we feel the difference from everyone else. In our home, the family I grew up in, we went to a lot of places together, and I saw my dad and I saw my brothers identifying with mom and my sister without shame and without embarrassment. I unconsciously accepted that obedience to Christ's words would make us different, and that's okay. In fact, it's good. And a willingness to be different in smaller things nurtures a capacity to swim against those strong, tsunami-like moral currents of this age. Anabaptists emphasize separation. The year was 296 AD, so go back, way back, to the Roman Empire. Maximilian was a young man that was turning 21 years old. His father, Fabius, loved his son and wanted to do something wonderful for him. And so he thought and he planned a surprise. In order to carry off the surprise, he went to the local military commander named Dion, and he said, "I want to enlist my son in the army." And then he went to the local tailor and had a special set of soldiers' clothes made for his son. At the birthday party for Maximilian, his father, Fabius, said, "Son, I have a surprise for you. I have enlisted you in the army, and here are your clothes." But instead of eliciting joy in his son, the son said, "Oh, father, I've become a Christian. I've become a follower of Christ. And that means I can't serve in the military." And his dad said, "Oh, I didn't realize that I knew you'd become a Christian, but I didn't realize that that would mean that you couldn't serve in the army." He said, "I've already enlisted you. I've already given your name, and you know what that means. It's either go forward with the enlistment or possibly die." And Maximilian agreed that he should go to the commander. But he said, "I'll go, but I won't enlist." The next day, we're told that Maximilian stood before Dion. And Dion's appeal was, "There are other Christians in the army. Can't you serve as well?" And Maximilian said, "No. I'm a follower of Jesus. I've been called to the way of Christ, and that does not include using violence to advance his kingdom. I can't serve in the army. I can't be a Roman soldier." And Dion began to become forceful. He said, "Now, don't be foolish here. Just let me put the badge on you, the soldier's badge, and I'll forget about the fact that you're a Christian." Because he said, "You know that even that is illegal." And Maximilian's response was, "I already wear Christ's badge. If you put the soldier's badge on me, I'll remove it." Dion was worked up. And so he said, "I have no choice. You're condemned to death by beheading." The other part of the story we know is that he was beheaded, and before his death, he turned to his father and asked him to take the set of clothes that his father had prepared to give him for his birthday, take those clothes and give them to the soldier that's about to kill me. This is a story that resonates with Anabaptists because on our best days, we're focused on loving and following and obeying Jesus Christ. And this means that we obey him even when it's unpopular, when it's hard, when it's deadly. But let's recognize that on our worst days, we substitute our different approach, our going the different direction, we substitute that for Christ. We trust in our own efforts, our comparative goodness. We trust the fact that we're different rather than Jesus. And all too often, we've been contemptuous and condemning of the people going the opposite direction. And that's not of him. I remember a number of years ago, I mentioned last evening the neighbors we had at Columbia, Frank and Linda Hargrove, and Presbyterian friends that were going to Indonesia. And they did. They went to Indonesia, and then they came back on furlough, and they were at our home. We were having a wonderful time. Their children, our children, were similar age and enjoying each other. And that evening, as we were sitting around talking and having a devotional time, Frank, the father of that family, he says, Stephen, I'd really like to pray, to offer a prayer of blessing for your family. Would you be open to that? And, well, of course. But his prayer was very memorable because he started something like this. He says, Lord, we thank you for the heritage, the community of strength that you've placed Stephen and Cynthia and their family in. And we thank you for the strength that and the stability that that brings to them and to their family. And I'm feeling good, you know, bring it on. And then Frank's prayer shifted, and he said, Lord, I pray that you would protect them from the coldness and the contempt that this can bring into their lives. And that really is the tension that we find ourselves in as a people. The scriptures call us. It's a glorious call to know Jesus, to follow Jesus, to love Jesus, to obey Jesus. And our heritage points us in the same direction. Anabaptism is a Christian tradition that has understood the radical, countercultural, upstream swimming, salmon-like nature of being a disciple of Christ. Historically, we have used the word nonconformity to describe this impulse, but perhaps I wonder sometimes if this word hasn't become too narrow to accurately describe this fundamental emphasis of Anabaptism. Nonconformity captures the second thing. It captures the negative side of the call. But let's not forget, there is a more central positive vision, Nachfolge Christi. And it is vital that we talk about this emphasis and that we cultivate an ability to talk about this emphasis in a positive way. If all we can say is that we dress differently and we don't go to war, our young people are going to find it incredibly difficult to get on board. And the older ones of us will have a form of Christianity without the passion, without the positive pursuit that characterized our forefathers. We've talked about three emphases. Anabaptism emphasizes brotherhood, submission, and separation. Nachfolge Christi, Christ focus and countercultural.